Tommy. The Angel of Mercy nursing home stood isolated out in Bourbon County, Kentucky, far from the living who shunned the place as a warehouse for those occupants waiting for God. The building was relatively modern, up to date, meeting the applicable fire codes. Tricia's first impression as she was driving up was that it was a depressing place. She had visited numerous nursing homes at various times, making various investigations for stories which sold quite readily. Everyone loved to see stories which exposed alleged abuse of senior citizens without it being pointed out that one day they may have to go into a home themselves. Truth is best served at arm's length. From the outside, Angel of Mercy looked well cared for, with what in summer would be a manicured lawn and a bright, cheery exterior. But it was late October. The grass had died back, the trees were without leaves, and the only sign that there was any cheer around the building were the Halloween decorations, which had probably been in place for at least a month. The door to the facility had specific instructions as to how to gain entrance by pushing a series of numbers on a keypad next to it. There was, no doubt, a similar keypad on the other side of the door which would prevent the internees from escaping the place, a genuine concern when many of those inside were suffering the dementia of Alzheimer's. Tricia gained entrance, then reported to the receptionist. "I came to see Thomas White," she told the man at the desk. "You mean Tommy?" he chuckled. "You're the first person from the outside to come and see Tommy in over a month. Sign in. You'll find him in room 315. Room 15 along the corridor 3. It'll be on the left if you go counterclockwise and around the circle." Tricia signed in, then quickly went to the room, knocking before entering. It was a cozy place, feeling more like the efficiency apartment she lived in immediately after she left her common-law husband than a typical nursing home room she had seen elsewhere. Inside the room to the left was a kitchenette, dominated by a microwave and a coffee maker. To the right, behind a door, was the toilet with a lavatory and a shower. In the room were a chest of drawers, a couch, an easy chair, and a bed. It appeared to be a normal bed until the occupant raised the back so he could greet his visitor. He looked tired. He was thin, with wispy strands of white hair on his head. His face was dominated by a large nose and deep, dark circles under his eyes. "Hello, who is it?" he said, his voice weak with age. "Mr. White, my name is Patricia Michaels. I'm a writer. I was told that you might be familiar with some of the people working the red light district in Covington a few years ago." "Red light district? In Covington? Can't say that I've heard of such a thing," he croaked, before turning his head away from his guest. "Mr. White, Tommy, it was Tommy, wasn't it?" He stayed quiet, trying to ignore her. "What happened in Covington, Kentucky, is in the past. No one wants to put you away, Tommy. I'm here trying to gather whatever information I can about how the houses worked in hopes of finding out what may have happened to a couple of people who disappeared the better part of 50 years ago. Specifically, Jim Brown from out at Possum Hollow in Fuller County, Ohio." A few moments of silence was punctuated with a soft knock at the door, followed by the entrance of a woman dressed in navy blue scrubs. "Did you require assistance, Tommy?" the nurse asked, walking past Tricia to join the old man by his bedside. She leaned close to him while he whispered something to her. "Of course, Tommy," she said quietly. The nurse turned toward Tricia. "Mr. White asked if you could wait out in the visitor's lounge for a few minutes while he composes himself. He needs some time to think and get dressed." Tricia smiled. "Certainly, Mr. White. Take your time. I'll be out in the lounge when you are ready." She left the room, wondering how long she would have to wait before Tommy White made an appearance, if he made an appearance at all. As it turned out, he showed up 20 minutes later, shuffling along behind a walker, accompanied by the nurse who had come into his room. "Mr. White is one of my favorite patients," the nurse explained to Tricia while Tommy was sitting down in a comfortable chair next to where she had been waiting. "He tells some amazing stories. Do you mind if I join you?" She pulled up another chair without waiting for Tricia's answer. The three of them spent a short bit of time silently sizing up each other before Tommy began to speak.
"Joe, you may not want to hear what I'm about to tell this young woman about a shameful part of my past."
"It's okay, Thomas," the nurse assured him. "We have no secrets. You know that." Thomas looked at Tricia, then back to the nurse.
"There's one secret I've kept. I used to deal in human flesh," he said quietly. "The young lady here, Miss Michaels, reminded me."
He looked directly at Tricia.
"I'm about to the end of my journey. What I did troubles me. I need to get it off my chest before I leave. Confession is good for the soul, I hear."
Tricia nodded slightly to affirm the old man's statement.
"Do you know if the houses are still in operation?" he asked.
"Not like they were back in your time, Tommy."
"What do you mean?" the nurse asked, seemingly confused. "Are you talking about houses of ill repute?"
"Yes, Toretta. Whorehouses. Places where men could go for pleasure apart from their wives."
The nurse, Toretta, blushed slightly.
"For a time, I worked in a house taking care of the girls, keeping them under control, keeping them working, keeping track of the money."
"You said girls, Tommy," Tricia remarked.
"Many of them were nothing more than just that. Girls. I am ashamed to say it, but we had them in there as young as 11 or 12, turning 2, 3, 4, or even more tricks a night."
Tommy stared vacantly into space while he continued.
"My job was to keep them confused when they got to the house. We'd feed them drugs, marijuana mostly, and we'd keep them drunk with rot gut whiskey and corn liquor. By the time the survivors came to the point where they weren't any use to us anymore, they'd be in the gutter, dead within 6 months."
"The survivors?" Toretta was taken aback by what she had just heard.
"Survivors," he repeated. "Girls that young turning as many tricks as they did didn't last too very long in a lot of cases, and get diseased, get torn up from the johns, get pregnant. No legitimate doctor would touch us, so we'd improvise. A girl getting torn up or pregnant was most likely to end up dead. I'd drive a girl from somewhere and never see her again."
"I assume the girls had back alley abortions," Tricia said to clarify what Tommy just stated.
"Yeah," he said quickly and quietly. "The Ross boys considered hiring a real doctor, but found it was easier just to find another girl."
"Which of the Ross boys?"
"Jerry Ross. He ran the operation. He had people in his pocket who knew how and where to get the girls for his houses. His people would go back in the hills and find a family in need of money and pay him to hand over their young'uns. The girls wouldn't be missed. No one would say anything about it, even the truant officers. If a girl was missing, they just figured she was off to a relative somewhere. Besides, they'd only be one girl from an area every couple of years just to keep suspicions down."
This Jerry Ross, do you know if he had a brother or a relative somewhere that you know of?
I think he had a brother named Johnny. I only met him once. That was back in the 50s, if I remember properly.
Do you remember what he looked like or where he was from?
I can't recall. No.
Did you ever hear the name Lou Gilbert?
Tommy started to shake his head, stopped, then nodded.
The name sounds familiar, but I can't place it.
Have you ever been to Ohio other than Cincinnati?
I've been to Portsmouth once or twice when we were kids, living in Vanceburg. But that was a long time ago. When I got into business after the war, I pretty much stayed over near Covington and Cincinnati. Ross said that Vanceburg wasn't safe for us no more, so we didn't go back.
Tommy paused for a few moments, then asked Joretta for a drink of water. After she got up and left the room, he leaned toward Tricia.
Ross had some kin over in that area who'd kill for him. Did more than one occasion, just like you see on television. He'd order a killing and it would get done. Still has a price on some heads. At least 5 people I know of, and if he knew about the questions you've been asking, he'd probably have a price on your head, too.
Would Jimmy Brown be one of the people with a price on his head?
His is one name mentioned, Miss Michaels. I heard he was in prison somewhere up in Ohio. His old man is living, too, and he's one of the others. Last I heard, Jerry Ross is still alive and still willing to have people killed in order to keep from having his name dragged through the mud.
You're not the first person to tell me that James Brown Sr. is still alive, Tricia told him. Do you know where I might find him? Tommy smiled but said nothing more. Joretta returned with his water. After he had a drink, he motioned for her, whispering something in her ear.
I'm sorry, Miss Michaels, but Tommy says he's tired. You'll have to come back another time, the nurse announced. With that, she helped the old man get up from his chair. The pair then went back to his room.
Tricia gathered her belongings after making a few notes in her ever-present portfolio before going back to the receptionist to sign out.
Old man White's wife is worth something else, isn't she? Watches him like a hawk, the man at the reception desk remarked.
That was his wife? Tricia asked.
Yes, she's considerably younger. She had a job here, and when he got to the point where he needed better care than what he was getting at home, she moved him into an apartment across the hall. She's on call 24/7, which works out well for all concerned.
When I came in, you said he hasn't had any visitors for a while.
Not from the outside. The last time anyone came to see him was yesterday. Some fellow came all the way from Ohio, if I call correctly. He was in and out faster than you were. Joretta chased the guy outside inside a minute. After that, she left a message at the desk to let her know if Tommy had any visitors.
Do you know who it was?
Now, let me see if I can find it in the logbook, the receptionist told her. Just a moment, or just a minute.
He spent several minutes looking at the book, breaking into a smile when he found what he was looking for.
It was some fellow by the name of Kendall. Harvey Kendall. Seemed like a real friendly fellow. I wonder why Joretta showed him to the door so quickly.
A thought coursed its way through her mind.
What was he? An older man? Younger man? How old would you say he was?
I don't know, maybe about 50 or so. He was dressed up like he was in a costume, if I recall.
What kind of costume?
Yeah, like a Western get-up. Boots, jeans, a plaid shirt, like a cowboy might wear.
Tricia felt someone lightly touch her shoulder. She turned around to face Joretta White.
Tommy said you were a writer and you're asking about Covington.
Yes, I'm a writer, freelance.
He told you about the killings, didn't he?
Yes, he said something about them.
You asked Mike about the visitor he had yesterday just now, Joretta said, indicating the receptionist.
He was one of them, sent by Jerry Ross. He gets around him and that smile of his. You may want to watch your back, though. He's part of the family. He's some nephew of some sort, defending the family name, you see. His mama was hooked up with that group, too. Mike's right. His name is Kendall. Harvey Oliver Kendall. Most people know him as Hoke.
Why, know him. I've spoken with him, Tricia told the nurse. But for some reason, I don't get the impression that he's out to kill anyone. There are people with secrets to hide regarding what your husband once did, as well as people willing to kill to keep those secrets hidden.
Tricia suggested moving the conversation back to a private setting, away from the receptionist. They moved back into the now empty visitor's lounge.
I didn't want to say anything in front of anyone else, Tricia continued, once they had settled back in the visitor's lounge. Harvey Kendall's daddy was an enforcer for the Ross brothers for a while. I understand that the Ross brothers are somehow still involved in illegal activities. As far as I can tell, Hoke has been keeping an eye on the brothers so he could clear his father. If you need help, or if Tommy wants to talk some more, let me know. I'll be glad to listen.
He's going into hospice tomorrow, Joretta revealed. He only has about a month left at best. No one else knows other than you.
Oh, call me after you get settled so I can do a follow-up, she told the nurse, handing her a business card. Hopefully I can get Tommy some peace of mind before he goes.
The family. Tricia left the nursing home with the uneasy feeling that she was being watched. At first, she dismissed the feeling as part of the still gray afternoon. After driving a few miles, her feeling turned into wariness. She wondered if someone else posing as one of Russell's men had somehow picked up her trail after the accident in Bardstown. On the other hand, it could be David, she thought. So she pulled off the side of the road at a small country store just over the river and waited. Before long, a car drove past, stopped about 200 yards away, changed directions, and made a beeline for the same store. Tricia hunkered down in her seat, keeping an eye out to see who it might be. The driver of the other car got out and looked around. It was Hoke.
"Where have you been?" she called out, catching his attention.
"I've been watching out for both of us," he said, walking to her car. "David told me about the accident yesterday afternoon. He sent me to watch out for you. It'd be less dangerous for me, considering."
"Well, get in. Let's talk."
Tricia leaned over and opened the passenger side door. Hoke got in. He explained that he had been out on his own for the past couple of days. He hadn't shaved, and his hair looked as if it were lived in.
"How's Mama?" he said.
"She's fine. A little worse for the wear, but she's out of Highland County lockup and resting at the bed and breakfast in Magnolia."
"And you met my daddy?"
"Yes. Unfortunately, he's in the lockup in Highland County, last I heard. Our lawyer is working on getting him released to Sheriff Roy in Fuller County to get him out of danger from Sheriff Hill."
"I suppose you might be a bit confused," Toke told her. "Daddy and me got involved in some nasty business. On the other hand, we also managed to get out of it after almost getting it shut down completely."
"So you worked as a white slaver too?"
"I was a kid. I had money, had pussy, had power. For some kid who'd run away from his mother at age 16 and dropping out of school, I had it made like a king. From what I've been told, you're doing a story about the Ross family. They're originally out of Vanceburg, Kentucky. There's still a bunch of them running around on either side of the Ohio River, mostly between Wheeling and Cincinnati. I was born into the family in a way. My natural daddy, worked as an enforcer for the Rosses. For the first part of my life, I was raised by my grandparents. They told me that I was a blessing to them, coming along so late in their lives. The only family other than them was my big sister. I adored her until I found out she was really my mother. I ran away from home when I found out. I ran straight to Fuller County, where I was picked up by Johnny Ross. Johnny Ross introduced me to Deputy Russell, saying something about how much I favored him. Deputy Russell come around and claimed me as his own. He told me the story about how he met my mother and then run off to the army when she found out she was going to have me.
I never had too much of an attachment to the man who I called father, so I found it real easy to become Quentin Russell Jr. As part of my becoming this other person, Quentin Sr. took me on some of his rounds, usually late at night or early in the morning, just before sunup. I come to the conclusion real quick that he was a bully. I also come to the conclusion that I really like the power which came from bullying other people. My education started to get out of hand. I started learning why my new daddy was bullying the people living up and down those country roads in the outskirts of nowhere. We'd go to these places and he'd tell me he found me a new girlfriend. We'd go to a house and he'd knock on the door till someone come out with a girl dressed in next to nothing. She'd get in the car with me and we'd drive for a while. Usually after daylight we'd come to a house somewhere out of town. He'd go and take what he called my new girlfriend out of the car, take off her clothes and would hump her right there in front of me. Sometimes he'd have me do it in front of him. After the humping, he'd leave me and take the girl away, never to be seen again. Trisha hung on every word Hoke was telling her. She looked out of the car window to see if the woman in the carryout was still watching. The woman vanished. I was told that there were killings, too, like what happened to the brown woman. Daddy told me that whoever told me that was lying. He never killed no one and never had to. But he had a reputation, she asserted. It was undeserved. Now, it's true that some of the girls we took and had our way with later died from being in the houses, but we never killed no one. There is a story going around that you and your father were the ones who killed Nadine Brown back in 67. Well, that was Joey Ross and his boy Gilbert. I heard exactly what happened from two eyewitnesses, David and Jim Brown. Well, you know that Fred Granger and David's sister Sally saw what happened too, don't you? Well, Fred never said anything to me in all the years I've known him, although I had a notion that he might have seen or known something. He was watching real close, you know. I know. I think he kind of suspects me of something. Maybe it has to do with the fact that his number got called and mine didn't. Your number? It took Trisha just a moment to recover. Oh, you mean your draft number. Uh-huh. He had some bad memories of being in NAM. I think he resented some of us who can't go or didn't go. Can't say as I blame him. And you got out of it. Yeah, I got out of it. I got out of the bullying business, too. Dad and me got out of it when he became real obvious that Sheriff Wilmer wasn't running things the way that Lou Gilbert wanted things run. Daddy pulled me aside when it became obvious that Preston Wilmer wasn't going to be elected sheriff again. He told me that I needed to go somewhere and start a clean slate. You adopted your mother's name then? Already had it. I just didn't use it from the time I ran away to the time when Daddy told me to start that clean slate. Trisha looked over toward the door of the carryout. A woman stood in the door glaring out at them. We're being watched, she told Hoke. I'd better get inside and at least make a token purchase. I'd best skedaddle myself, he grinned. I have other business to attend to. Hoke went his own way. Trisha left her car to go into the store. You'd best be gone if you know what's good for you. Trisha was ambushed by the storekeeper almost immediately after entering the establishment. I already called the law. That man you was with, the state police is after him for murder of someone up in Highland County, Ohio. That's news to me, Trisha shot back. I've known him for years. Nice guy. Wouldn't harm anyone. I heard he almost cut some woman's head off. Well, it's a good thing he's gone now, isn't it? Trisha grabbed the first likely snack item she saw and laid it on the counter along with a $5 bill. You're lucky he didn't kill both of us, the shopkeeper grumbled. The woman totaled up Trisha's purchases and made change. She only got as far as the door when she was confronted by a state trooper on his way in. You're the driver of the White Avenger outside? The trooper asked, ushering her back in. Yes, sir. Trisha had enough sense to put her purchases back on the counter and produce her identification. Is this the woman you called about, ma'am? This trooper asked the storekeeper. That's the one. I saw her talking with that Russell Jr. person they've had on the news. A second trooper came in the store. It's a rental.
Company said it was rented by a person named Patricia Lynn Michaels. The first trooper confirmed the identification. Were you aware that the person you're talking to in the parking lot is wanted for questioning regarding to a murder in Highland County? I was almost accused of murder myself, Tricia told them. There must be a misunderstanding. She then proceeded to tell the trooper about the situation. After 15 minutes of questions and cross-examinations, she was finally let go with a warning that she was to be in contact with the police if she ever ran into Quentin Russell Jr. again. Her cell phone rang when she was a good 5 miles down the road. I'm headed to Brown's place up in Fuller County, Hope told her. I'll give you a call when I get there to guide you in. If you haven't heard from me by the time you cross the county line, get back over to Magnolia quick. There might be trouble a-brewin'.